On To the Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Donald Trump is probably the most significant thing to happen to the religious right in a few decades.
OMG, this guy is actually a bigot.
If she becomes president, no one since Richard Nixon would have been on the national stage that long and won the White House.
I'm Warren Olney. To the Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To the Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
Americans are willing to work and work hard. But right now, an awful lot of people feel there is less and less respect for the work they do, and less respect for them, period. Democrats, we are the party of working people. But we haven't done a good enough job showing we get what you're going through, and we're going to do something to help. So tonight I want to tell you how we will empower Americans to live better lives. My primary mission as president will be to create more opportunity and more good jobs with rising wages right here in the United States.
That's Hillary Clinton speaking at the Democratic convention last week in Philadelphia. Those wages are already getting hiked here in Los Angeles and in California. But who's going to make sure those laws are enforced? UCLA researchers estimate that employers steal $26 million every week from LA's low-wage workers. And KCRW found that most of those workers will never get that money back. Well, this week we'll be airing a five-part series that investigates the treatment of low-wage workers at LA restaurants, from stolen paychecks to injuries on the job to retaliation against workers that complain, sexual assault, even human trafficking. KCRW investigative reporter Karen Fauché and her researcher Miguel Contreras spent hundreds of hours going over wage theft claims and meeting with restaurant workers and experts. And Karen joins me right now to talk about it. Hi.
Hi, Steve.
Wow. That's a lot of work. Why did you decide to focus solely on the restaurant industry?
I started looking at several industries, and as I was doing my research, folks, investigators, prosecutors, persons most knowledgeable of this issue said, you know, you really should look into restaurants. And when I looked at some of the reports, the restaurant industry is at the top of the list for a lot of these things, for injuries, for wage theft, for labor trafficking. It seemed like a natural fit. It's where we needed to look.
And to be sure, it happens everywhere, not just in the restaurant industry.
Absolutely. I mean, Los Angeles is the wage theft capital of America. Our wage theft is 20% higher than other parts of the country. This is in car washes, garment industries, construction. It's everywhere. But you really see a lot of it in the restaurant industry.
Let's talk about wage theft. These are workers who are underpaid, right? And you met with some of them. I want to hear what they told you.
Let's go around real quickly and just ask each person just to tell me quickly how much they think they're owed.
A mí me deben
$31,000. The company owes them $31,000.
How about this gentleman?
¿A ti cuánto te deben?
Como 23.
$23,000.
A mí me consiguieron 27.
$27,000.
Pero me robaron medio millón.
25.
$25,000.
Thousands of dollars.
I talked to a woman on Friday who's owed $120,000. She's had to move in with her sister. She's lost everything because the restaurant went belly up and won't pay her judgment. I've talked to people who have become homeless. This is devastating.
How does this happen, Karen, in America 2016?
Well, wage theft happens in a couple ways. It can be not paying your overtime, working off the clock, meal and rest breaks aren't paid. California has some of the strongest labor laws in the country, Steve, no doubt. The problem is there isn't a lot of enforcement of those. And so what happens is a lot of the workers are undocumented. They're scared to go forward. And so this just kind of keeps happening. And if they say anything, they can be retaliated against. They can be fired. And then they find themselves out of work.
Do we have any idea of how many restaurants do this? Like, is this just a common thing in restaurants when you go out to eat at a nice place? Are you thinking, wow, the people in the kitchen are probably being having money stolen from them?
There are some great restaurant owners. I'm not saying this is happening in every restaurant. The number of the data is actually pretty difficult to pinpoint, but a Department of Labor study found that 84% of restaurants and fast food restaurant workers were experiencing wage theft. The State Labor Commissioner, the agency responsible for enforcing wage laws in California, says that restaurants owe the most of all the industries, over 8 million. So it's at the top of the list. And again, we're not seeing every restaurant. And that's part of the problem, Steve, is finding out who's actually doing this. This is why we spent hundreds of hours going through data, trying to determine who's actually committing this. It was difficult.
It's difficult. And as they say, they're owed this money. They believe they're owed this money. The judgment is there against the employer. Even if the workers do manage to win a suit for back pay, it's even hard for them to collect, to actually get paid on that claim. Here's Matt Ciroli of the Wage Justice Center.
The last time the data was looked at by the UCLA Labor Center, it was 17% who recovered anything on the judgments that they got. So about 1 in 5 was their chances of seeing anything at all, you know, a penny on the judgment.
A penny on the judgment.
Yeah, you know, we decided to look at this data ourselves, and we looked at about 2,600 wage claims, and we whittled it down, Steve, to about 440 judgments. These are pieces of paper that say, this restaurant owes me money. And we wanted to find out for ourselves, well, how successful are these people? And guess what? We found out 75% of those judgments were not paid. Over $6 million was owed to this group of workers we looked at. And yet, Steve, only $600,000 has been collected.
So very few workers actually try to complain about this, right? Because they're afraid. They're afraid of being deported. They're afraid of being found out. They're afraid of retaliation.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I heard I can't tell you how many people told me, you know, I lost my job when I complained. One woman told me her family, the owner, threatened to call ICE on her family. They feel like there's very little recourse. And Steve, when people do go through this process, this wage claim process, it's a long, painful process. And if the worker doesn't show up for one meeting, that case is thrown out. And then, as we just talked about, you get this piece of paper. Good luck trying to recover that money. It's a shell game I saw played by so many restaurants, where just a simple name change, moving the company into
really,
their brother.
Really, a name change.
$300, you go pay. I found several restaurants that simply change the name of the restaurant, and suddenly they can dodge $400,000 judgment. It's a shell game that we're used to seeing on Wall Street. It's played right here on Main Street by restaurants right here in LA.
So what can be done? I mean, if you have a piece of paper that says you owe me, and if it is indeed this shell game, aren't there lawyers out there? Aren't there people, advocates for these social workers, whomever, who can say, all right, we're watching this happen. We're watching what you do. I'm saying to the employers, we're watching what you do, and now you still have to pay.
Well, there's the labor commissioner. They don't have enough lawyers. I think there's about 100 to cover the 40,000 wage claims filed every year. There's one every 4 minutes, not enough lawyers. And those low wage workers, I'm not talking just the restaurant industry, any industry really that needs help, you got to find a lawyer. Well, I found out that there's only about 70 in the entire state of California for millions of workers. We're talking about low public interest legal aid attorneys. There are no lawyers. A lawyer is not going to take your case, Steve, that's worth $5,000 when he has to spend 200 hours finding out who owns the restaurant. So what we find is these workers are out of luck. Now, there's a state law that was just passed this year that allows the labor commissioner to go after hard assets, homes, bank accounts that they normally couldn't do. But again, there's maybe 30 people in the whole office that can handle this. There's just
throughout
not
the
enough
state
people.
Of California.
Yeah.
38, 39 million people.
For years, the state of California had not one attorney assigned all the retaliation complaints at the state. The state is under-resourced big time when it comes to this.
I mentioned retaliation. I mentioned that these workers feel threatened if they do go forward about this. I want you to talk about this man named Rafael Rosales, who also worked at a restaurant. It's called Carousel, I believe, in Glendale. And he filed suit against the restaurant. And then he got a visit at his home. Tell us what happened.
Carousel is a famous, the Kardashians love it. They think they go to the one in Hollywood. Mr. Rosales and his two co-workers worked at the one in Glendale. Mr. Rosales was home one day and he gets a knock at the door, and it's two men he's never seen. One has a Frogtown gang tattoo on his head, and they basically said they were there to settle his wage claim. That they didn't want him to continue doing this, and they were going to pay him a little money. And they're nice today, but tomorrow they're not going to be so nice. And he was terrified. And he said, well, what are you doing here? And they said, well, we're representing the restaurant. And he took that as a threat of violence. The owner of Carousel has said he has no idea how these gang members ended up at this man's house. He doesn't know. He has no idea. But somehow this was these men ended up at this guy's door, and he actually filmed it. We have that on our website.
Wow. It sounds like the law firm of, like, Fist and Spurs or something, right?
Well, again, the owner says, I don't know. I have no idea how this happened.
Yeah.
The case settled confidentially for an unknown sum.
We're talking to KCRW investigative reporter Karen Fauché about her five-part series. It started today, by the way. You'll hear it again on All Things Considered as well later this afternoon. It's called Burned. Injuries on the job are a big deal as well. People get hurt, not only in the restaurant business, but obviously in other businesses as well.
Yeah, when I was meeting with this one group of wage theft victims, Steve, this kind of came out of nowhere. They started showing me all of their cell phones, their photo galleries of all the injuries. I had not gone there to see this, and I was really kind of surprised. Nearly severed thumbs. The story started to come out that their owners say, you can't go to the hospital. We don't have workers' comp. You're going to have to go to this little clinic. So I actually visited one of these clinics, not run by a doctor, but I was told that this is quite prevalent.
Not run by a doctor.
No. Many of these workers seek out clinics, kind of fly-by-night clinics, or they get visitors to their homes at night from people that pretend to be doctors. This is what they have to do because some of the employers will not allow them to go to the hospital. If they go, I've talked to several who are then fired.
How do you call something a clinic if it's not run by doctors?
You can get away with it. And
legally, you can get away with it?
This fellow is, and he's treating them the best he can. And he told me, these are big-time chains that we all know that send their employees there. Again, he thinks to avoid higher insurance premiums and workers' comp. And in fact, the records show that the restaurant industry is one of the top for workers' claim violations. Restaurant owners don't have it.
There are some new rules coming into effect, though, to offset this, I understand.
Yeah, today's a big day, actually, for worker safety. For the first time, the Federal OSHA, the agency responsible for protecting
Occupation and Health Occupation and Health Safety Administration.
Correct. Today, they're increasing the penalties by 78%. This is the first time, Steve, that these penalties have been increased in 26 years. So that means employers are going to have to pay more for workplace accidents. It also means that some of the data that was normally held from the public, we didn't have access to some of the data on workplace incidents. That's becoming public. But Steve, in the restaurant industry, I found there's very, very little inspections of restaurants. I think there was about 560 in the past 6 years. Part of the reason, Steve, the restaurant industry isn't considered a high-hazard industry, we only have one inspector for every 82,000 workers.
Wait, not a high-hazard industry. There is fire at a restaurant. Am I wrong?
There is, and we did find some. I found a few fatalities. But compared to other industries like construction or other industrial industries, it's just not considered high-hazard. And when you have so few resources, Steve, they're just not going to put them towards the restaurant industry.
It goes beyond theft and intimidation and injuries as well. You tell the story of Maria Vasquez, who worked for Art Boone at the restaurant Arts Wings and Things. What happened to her?
She claimed she was repeatedly assaulted, raped for years by this man, pulled in the storage area. Tuesdays became the worst day of the week for her because she said she would open the store. He would meet her there to give her the key, and he would rape her before the store would open. These are her claims. We've tried to reach out to Mr. Boone with no luck. And apparently she's not alone. She told me another person was. I found that this was that sexual assault within the restaurant industry is just something that's not reported. And it's probably much more prevalent than we know of.
So sexual assault, human trafficking, we mentioned at the outset, which is also prevalent as well. And all of this happening. It amazes me because I think the common thread of all of this, and we talked about it earlier in the program, was the fact that a lot of these folks are undocumented. And they fear being deported. They fear being caught.
Yeah, Maria, the rape victim, I said, why didn't you go to the police? And she said, I couldn't. I had six kids I had to support. He threatened to call ICE on my family. So she stayed silent for years. I heard that over and over and over. And I think maybe some employers know that and play upon that.
Karen Fauché is an investigative reporter for KCRW. The series is airing this week, the very first one today. You'll hear it on All Things Considered a little later this afternoon and this evening on KCRW. And by the way, to read more about the worst restaurants that she found, check out kcrw.com/investigations. Karen Fauché, thank you. Good work. We'd like to hear from you. Have you worked in a restaurant and experienced this kind of treatment? Have you stopped going to a place because it treats its workers badly? You can reach us on Twitter or Facebook at KCRW. Press play. Coming up, there are new rules when it comes to labeling food that contains genetically modified ingredients. And agribusiness approves. That's next on Press Play.
Santa Monica-based public radio station KCRW relies on the support of its listeners. One way to help is by donating your old car, truck, boat, or motorcycle. We'll pick up the vehicle from anywhere in the country. Put your old ride to good use and take advantage of a great tax write-off. Visit kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Steve Chiotakis in for Madeline Brand. Here's a question for you. How closely do you look at the labels of the foods that you eat? Well, soon you're going to have more information to consider in the supermarket aisle. President Obama signed a new law just a couple of days ago requiring food makers to label items that contain genetically modified ingredients. There's no scientific evidence that GMOs pose any kind of health risk. So what is the logic behind the new law? Alan Bierga covers agriculture and food for Bloomberg News. He's with us right now. Hey, Alan.
Hello.
What does this new bill do, by the way? GMOs will have to be labeled, but food companies will have choices for how they're labeled. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, one of the immediate things that this law achieves is it preempts a Vermont state law that had required labeling of genetically modified ingredients that was potentially going to cost a lot of money for food companies, both to print up new labels and to potentially reformulate some products so that there wouldn't be genetically modified ingredients. By making a national law, you have both preempted Vermont and you have kept other states from passing laws too. You've created a federal standard. What this does in the longer term, and this is going to be implemented over the next 2 years, is you create a mandatory labeling system for genetically modified ingredients. However, that doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be on your food label. There was allowance in this law made for, say, QR codes, where if a person were to scan their food with an app, they could then look up a printout that would have a bunch of information, including GMOs. Also, there's not a lot of teeth in terms of enforcement for this, as well as an interpretation of what a genetically modified ingredient is that's being left up to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. So there's going to be a lot of devil in the details in the next couple of years. We know there's some sort of labeling, but it may not be something that a consumer can easily access, and we're still not exactly sure what the definitions will be.
So this is kind of lip service, if you will.
Well, I wouldn't quite say lip service. I mean, if a person wants to find out whether there are GMOs in their food, they should be able to do this under this law. But one of the arguments that folks who were pushing for a more clear on-label requirement is that, look, people walking around grocery stores don't necessarily have apps downloaded where they can scan and find out what's in their food. This is available for a motivated consumer, but if you're somebody who's harried for time or maybe somebody who's just struck by the question one day, you're not necessarily going to be in a position to find out.
Let's back up a little bit, Alan, and talk about GMOs in the first place. How extensively have they been researched? And what does the science say about the health factor? A lot of people say that, you know, they're really bad for you. But does science back that up?
You know, having looked at this issue for quite a few years, it's striking to look at this debate compared to some other debates, because you don't see a scientific consensus that there are problems with any genetically modified ingredients. There's a lot of consumer skepticism, and I sometimes wonder if that's even really about the science as much as it is concerned that a genetically modified ingredient sort of stands for sort of the processed, big food, industrialized agricultural system that you've seen emerge that said people worry about putting that into their bodies. You can find people who are skeptical about GMO safety in food. You can find people who are skeptical about global warming. But when you look at a scientific consensus, it just doesn't seem to show up that people are having problems because of genetic modification in their food. But what that genetic modification represents in terms of the food system, that can be a much bigger question, and this becomes a proxy in that fight.
Do you think it's like the vaccine debate? A lot of well, there are some folks, and I wouldn't say a lot of folks, but some folks who believe, you know, A plus B equals C, and ergo we have a problem.
Well, there is correlation and causation, and people have anecdotes and personal experiences, and you can't say there would never be a risk for genetically modified food or plant. That's why you have testing regimes. That's why you have the European Union taking a more skeptical attitude when the basis of their food safety system is much more precautionary than what you see in the U.S. But when you look at what's been on the market, and we now have about a 20-year history of experience with these ingredients, you're not seeing health concerns show up. What you see is concerns about how food is produced generally, about the companies like Monsanto having real power over research and new products, and that sort of centralization of the food system that people seem to instinctively react against.
What are they reacting against then? What don't we know, or what are they saying we don't know?
Well, one thing that you simply don't know is necessarily how all the chemicals and ingredients all work together. You don't necessarily know what are the implications of the whole principle of patenting life, which is part of having a genetic modification in a plant. You wonder about new processes that are coming into the system, and these are going to be the next generation of battles, and what implications they may have compared to the research and advances that we've already had. There's always a lot of unknown out there, but what you also have is a lot of just outrage over folks who seem to be doing things with food, and consumers don't necessarily understand what's going on. How much that these labels will help towards dispelling that goal, I think, is something that people are looking at with a lot of skepticism towards, because this is a debate that's been going on for 20 years, and a QR code on a label isn't necessarily going to end it.
A debate, and you know, to look at the teeth of a law, I think you look at who's happy about it and who's not so happy about it. So let's talk about those things. Who's happy about this bill?
Well, agribusiness is very happy about this bill. It didn't give them everything they wanted, but it definitely gave them what they needed, which was preempting the Vermont law, creating some sort of national standard, and potentially, once these rules get written, some regulatory certainty that will allow them to go ahead with their research and their plans on a little more solid ground. People who were not happy about this were the folks that wanted a national standard on the label. You know, there are dozens of countries on this planet that have managed to make something like that work. The fact that you have a solution where you have a mandatory label, but it's not necessarily a label a person can easily see, really strikes people the wrong way, especially when you have seen some of these consumer surveys showing that, you know, people would like to know what's in their food, and they'd like it to be easier for them to figure out what it is.
Alan Bjerga from Bloomberg News, I got to ask you, if putting labels, some sort of label, GMO label on these foods, does it create a stigma? Sort of like, you know, like the cigarette, I don't want to, obviously this is apples and oranges, but putting a warning label on cigarettes tells you that that's bad for you. Will people correlate it?
No. I think you should go ahead and go there and make the comparison with cigarettes.
Let's do it then. All right, go ahead.
Let's bring it on. I think you have the point that agribusiness has been trying to make, which is when you put a label on food that isn't necessarily about safety, because the science has not shown a problem with safety, or about nutrition, that label can imply that there is something about this product that should maybe make you go do something else. You know, a lot of folks in the organic foods community thought that these labels would be a good thing for them because it would just raise that suspicion in a consumer's mind. And it's because of the example of smoking. Another question is just real estate on a label. You know, by the time you get all the nutrition information in there and all the marketing claims and stuff, GMOs is just one other piece of information, you know, that people have to put around whatever cute little animal or picture of something incredibly healthy that they want to do to get you to buy that product. So real estate becomes an issue. And yes, that question of stigma in the mind of consumers was definitely on the mind of lobbyists when they were working on this bill.
Let's underscore the fact that the warning label on a pack of cigarettes, I think, pretty much tells you exactly what's going on there.
Well, and stronger all the time. I mean, pretty soon they're just going to be showing like really diseased people to get you to not smoke.
Very quickly, Alan, do you think it's going to change eating habits by looking at this?
You know, that's a really good question, and it's really the unknowable one. A lot of things are changing people's eating habits, you know, from studies on obesity to consumer marketing efforts to try to avoid further government regulation by encouraging people to be healthier. You know, could this affect diets? Could this affect reformulations? Certainly, companies can still claim that things don't have GMOs. If they want to show that they're GMO-free, they are free to claim that. And that affects eating habits, but it's part of such a large, complicated mix, and this is really only one aspect of it. It's going to be hard to tease out whatever sort of impact this will have. What we do have is a consistent standard, even if it may not necessarily be the most transparent one.
Alan Bjerga, covering agriculture and food for Bloomberg News. Alan, thanks for your time.
Hey, thank you.
I appreciate it. Do you avoid GMO foods? Let us know why or why not at 844-PRESS-PLAY or on our Facebook at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, how the modern conservative movement started right here in the Golden State during the Great Depression.
In order to break apart a coalition of middle class and working class voters, conservatives can emphasize cultural wedge issues. And that's exactly what they started doing in 1934.
In 1934, the big business roots of party politics on the right. Next on Press Play.
Listen to KCRW's music stream, Eclectic 24, for handpicked music around the clock. You can find all of KCRW's produced content on our app. Download it for free at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Steve Chiotakis, in for Madeline Brand. Well, Donald Trump spent a week at the Republican convention telling people how he's going to make America great again. It essentially was the same message that Republican Herbert Hoover delivered as he campaigned for president in 1932. Hoover was campaigning hard against his Democratic rival, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and against FDR's so-called New Deal, with messages warning that the government had grown too big, that freedom was under attack, that the American way was in danger of collapsing. All conservative talking points that survive even today. Well, UC Davis historian Catherine Olmsted's latest book argues that the fight against the New Deal launched modern conservatism and today's Republican Party as we know it. The book is called Right Out of California, and Madeline Brand spoke with Olmsted earlier in the year. She began the interview by asking what happened after Herbert Hoover lost that election in 1932 and why he took it so personally.
I think it was both personal and ideological. I mean, personally, he had lost the election, and he was furious about that because he felt he really had a lot to offer the country. But also, he sincerely believed that Roosevelt was going to take the country in the wrong direction, and not just the wrong direction, but straight off a cliff. And he was convinced the Depression was going to get worse and worse, and that Roosevelt was going to have some sort of social revolution that would cause everyone who already had wealth and property to lose it. And so he decided he was going to rally his fellow wealthy businessmen around the country to oppose Roosevelt.
And one of those wealthy businessmen was Harry Chandler, the publisher of the Los Angeles Times. And why was he particularly opposed to the New Deal?
Well, Chandler was an arch conservative. He he was perhaps the richest man in California, if not the whole West, because he had invested heavily in real estate, and he owned hundreds of thousands of acres and vast corporate farms, both in the U.S. and in Mexico. And he was, like all the large growers in California, he was very happy that the New Deal was planning these big infrastructure projects that would bring irrigation water to the corporate farms. But he was very worried about Roosevelt's labor policies.
And what in particular was he worried about when it came to labor? Because as you say in your book, the New Deal did not include protections for farm workers.
Right. And so this is one of the interesting complexities. In 1933, there was a law passed called the National Industrial Recovery Act that included a section that protected workers who wanted to form a union. And these protections applied only to industrial workers, not to agricultural workers. The Southern Democrats, who were part of FDR's coalition, had insisted that they were not going to support any laws that helped farm workers or domestic workers because they didn't want their sharecroppers to form a union. So there was this revolutionary labor law that was passed, but it did not apply to farm workers. However, the farm workers didn't know that. And all they knew was that they heard that the president wants you to join a union, that now suddenly it was going to be possible. So they started organizing these unions. And then when the growers refused to recognize the unions, they went out on strike.
And then also part of this at the same time was a growing communist party and then a growing fear of communists. You know, this is after the Russian Revolution, and there are people in California and elsewhere who are quite taken with the ideas of communism, of Soviet Russia. And that is tied in with this labor struggle. How did the two get tied in together?
Well, there were no established unions that were interested in organizing farm workers. It was a very hard job to organize farm workers because they're migratory. So if you get a union together, if you finally succeed in getting the workers to organize, then in a couple of weeks, the crop is harvested and they all move on. Also, in California, most of the farm workers were immigrants. A lot of them didn't speak English. They couldn't vote. They were desperately poor, among the poorest people in America, so they couldn't pay union dues. And so for that reason, the American Federation of Labor, other established unions did not try to organize the fields. So this left it open for communists who were interested in organizing farm workers as part of their ideological project because they saw the farm workers as among the most dispossessed and therefore the most potentially revolutionary people in America. So when the growers saw that these unions, which they were unalterably opposed to any unions, were being organized by communists, it made it all the more objectionable.
And one of them is a fascinating character. Her name is Caroline Decker. She's a young woman you describe as more Lana Turner than Mother Jones. You know, she's kind of glamorous and she wore heels. Tell us more about her.
Well, she was a native-born American from Georgia. She had a very charming Southern accent. She was just 21 in 1933. She was petite, blonde hair, blue-eyed, very charming and charismatic. And she was a perfect organizer for the Communist Party, which was trying to project the image of Americanism, that this was a safe American party, not foreign-directed. And the party at that time offered a lot of opportunities for women that other institutions did not, because at least in theory, the Communist Party was dedicated to gender equality. And so they tended to put women front and center and give them more opportunities to be the leader of a union, say. And so Decker and many other women seized this opportunity that the Communist Party gave them to be important and to speak in front of thousands of people and to organize a massive labor action.
So she did, and she helped organize a huge labor action in the cotton fields, and tens of thousands of workers went out on strike, and there were many other strikes throughout the state in the 1930s. What was the reaction? How did the growers react to these strikes?
Well, they were furious. They decided that they had to do anything possible to get the workers back in the fields. So they used their influence with local law enforcement. They would get the strikers arrested for vagrancy, which was sort of an all-purpose charge. They also would use the CHP to clear the highways to prevent people from picketing. And, you know, most notably what they did was incite vigilante attacks on the striking workers, which in the cotton strike of 1933 resulted in three workers getting shot to death.
Mm-hmm. Also, you tell an interesting story of spying on and infiltrating communist groups. There's a man who is running this operation. It becomes a massive operation. His name is Ralph von Diemen. Tell us about him.
Well, this is one of the more interesting stories that I found in researching this book. There was this retired general in San Diego, Ralph Van Diemen, who was known as the father of military intelligence, because when he was in the army in the Philippines back in 1899, he had helped create modern military intelligence. And then when he came back to Washington, D.C. during World War I, he set up the first military intelligence division. So he was a man who knew spying. And he retired to San Diego at the end of the 1920s. And then when Franklin Roosevelt got elected in 1932 and there were all these strikes in California in 1933, Van Diemen decided that he needed to set up a spy network that would spy upon these union activists and other people he considered subversive. And he set up what ultimately became a really massive spy network that encompassed not just California, but many Western states and spread into Mexico. And he had in his bungalow in San Diego, he filled it with file cabinets that contained all of these reports that were meticulously cross-indexed and filed on what turned out to be, by the time of his death in the 1950s, about a couple hundred thousand people.
And then the spying continued on Californians until about 1970.
Yes. And so then when he died, the Army and the FBI and a couple of red hunting committees in Congress continued to use those files until the 1970s.
So here we see the seeds of modern conservatism, the anti-communist mentality that went on, and that was certainly a hallmark in both Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan's presidencies. They were both virulently anti-communist. What else did you see this in terms of the seeds planted in the 1930s that then bore fruit later on in future decades?
Well, what I think is especially important was the election in California in 1934, the governor's election, which was between a conservative incumbent, a Republican named Frank Merriam, who was the far right of the Republican Party, and the Democrats nominated a socialist, author Upton Sinclair, who had written The Jungle and more than 40 other books. And during that election, the people with wealth and power in California were so terrified by the prospect of Sinclair becoming governor that they spent an unprecedented amount of money. We still don't know exactly how much because most of it was secret, to hire political consultants. And this was the first time that political consultants had been used. And these political consultants then used this money to do a lot of research to figure out how to convince Californians not to support Sinclair, not to support socialism. And what they discovered is that there was a lot of support for Sinclair's economic ideas in the depths of the Depression, but that a lot of middle-class Californians were turned off by what they perceived as his alleged atheism. And so they created a lot of the techniques that we still see used today, where in order to break apart a coalition of middle class and working class voters, conservatives can emphasize cultural wedge issues. And that's exactly what they started doing in 1934.
And we are still in the midst of a debate, a very virulent debate in some quarters over the power of unions.
Right. And this is what the businessmen in California and the conservative activists like Hoover understood from the beginning, is that Roosevelt, by trying to level the playing field between labor and business, by protecting the right to join the union, was really starting a revolution in the American economy and in American politics, that social democracy depends on workers being able to organize collectively so that they can have power vis-a-vis businessmen. And that's why the businessmen were so angry. And it is a revolution in labor laws in the United States in 1933 that conservatives have been working ever since to overturn.
And so what happened to all those communists, and especially to Caroline Decker? Where did they end up?
Well, this was another thing that the growers did. In addition to hiring the vigilantes to attack the workers, they also organized and worked with local DAs and with state prosecutors to bring charges of sedition against the union leaders. And there was a massive trial in Sacramento in 1935. It was the biggest and longest trial in California history at that point, where 19 leaders, including Caroline Decker, union leaders, were put on trial, and 8 of them were convicted, including Decker. And she was sent to state prison and served 3 years before her sentence was overturned by an appeals court. And so when she came out, she was disillusioned. And so she dropped out of the party and ultimately married a civil liberties attorney and became a housewife in Marin. And this happened to several of the communist organizers in the 1930s, is the combination of prison and their disillusionment with the Communist Party. And then the Cold War after World War II meant that they stopped their union organizing.
But when you look at California now, this is a blue state. This is, by all accounts, one of the more liberal states. Jerry Brown is the governor. We have 2 Democratic senators. Did the conservatives win?
Well, they certainly didn't win in California. But I think if you look nationally, they seem to be doing pretty darn well. California had a demographic change that has led to a much different population and a much more liberal voting base. And so right now we think of California as a very liberal state, and of course it is, but it does have this history of also giving birth to the modern conservative movement.
Catherine Olmsted is professor and chair of the history department at UC Davis. Her latest book is called Right Out of California: The 1930s and the Big Business Roots of Modern Conservatism. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you.
Coming up on this program, reality TV is still big business a quarter century after The Real World premiered on MTV. Remember that show? Just ask the millions of people who will turn in tonight for the season finale of The Bachelorette. That's coming up next on Press Play.
Listen to the Rhythm Planet podcast to explore music from all corners of the globe. Brazilian, European, African, and tropical Latin. Rhythm Planet is a state of mind. Listen at kcrw.com/rhythmplanet or on KCRW's app.
This is Press Play. I'm Steve Chiotakis in for Madeline Brand. It is the night that fans have been waiting for, the final rose ceremony on ABC's The Bachelorette. And perhaps a big question on your mind is whether JoJo will choose the former competitive swimmer or the former football quarterback. Or maybe the bigger question is whether reality shows such as The Bachelorette are still capturing viewers. And how has the reality TV scape changed since the early days of The Real World and Survivor? June Thomas is culture critic for Slate. Welcome.
Thank you.
Matt Bellany is the executive editor at The Hollywood Reporter and Billboard. Hi, Matt.
Hi there.
June, you somehow got coaxed into watching The Bachelorette, and you're here willing to admit just that. What's going on with you? Is it a guilty pleasure, do you think, for a lot of people, or did it become a guilty pleasure for you?
It is something that I can only watch with fast forward. And I don't say that with any kind of attitude. I'm not one of these people who, you know, hates reality television or anything like that. I just find that if I make a commitment to something like The Bachelor or The Bachelorette, my life is going to be over and all my other shows are going to get lost because it's such a time commitment. But I have to admit that if you watch just one episode, I think it's very difficult not to at least, you know, tune in and see who's being emo and who's freaking out because it is extraordinarily watchable.
is it one of those things, June, do you think that, you know, people talk about this, they're sort of like a keeping up with the Joneses, right? They're at the water cooler, maybe you're at work and you're having a conversation with somebody or the other office workers, and you want to know what this is all about.
There definitely is that, but I don't think that it's a manufactured liking of these shows. I know several people, smart people, who are in bachelor and bachelorette fantasy leagues. This is a true phenomenon. And apparently, I've seen, I don't know if studies is quite the appropriate word, but I've seen that these shows are particularly popular with women who earn over $100,000. You know, this is not, you know, there's a, I think, an erroneous, but still a view that reality shows are popular with dumb people. And I don't think that's the case in the Bachelor franchise's case. There's something about that show. There's something about the search for love, or just the idea that you could focus your entire life on the search for love as they do when they're sequestered in their fantasy islands and so on, that really appeals to people.
The search for love has been, you know, the underlying theme to pretty much everything that Hollywood does, right?
Yeah. And the other reality shows seem to be about the search for a job, which is about as sort of unsexy as you can get, but, you know, just as important in life.
You know, Matt Bellany, The Bachelorette is in season 12. I did not know this. I knew it's been around for a while. The Bachelor has been around for 20 seasons, which amazes me. How is this so popular? Why is it still going strong like it is right now?
I think it's still going strong because they have really honed in on the target audience here. The Bachelor ratings are fine. It's never, you know, been this huge juggernaut, you know, in the style of American Idol or The Voice or those big competition shows. But it always delivers that reliable women 18 to 34, women 18 to 49 audience that that is lucrative to advertisers. So ABC keeps renewing it. And, you know, they have Bachelor-related programming on for about 9 months of the year between Bachelor, Bachelorette, and Bachelor in Paradise and all the other, you know, offshoots. They have a franchise.
But you guys, this, I mean, I remember when reality TV was new. Now, we're dating back to The Real World, right? Remember that first season in New York? And I think about how inexpensive those shows were. Like, we're just going to follow you around with a camera. It's not like that anymore, is it?
It's about a quarter of the cost of a scripted show, though, I hear.
Still today.
I mean, it's something like The Bachelorette. Sure, they go, I mean, this season they've been in Argentina, they've been in Thailand, they're in these beautiful fantasy suites. But, you know, that really, compared to the cost of a writer's room and building sets and all of that stuff, I think it's still an amazing bargain. And, you know, the people who take part are, you know, they are, seem to be as happy as Larry to be on there. So it does seem like it's both a bargain and something that really attracts people over and over and over again.
Is it a bargain, though, Matt? Yeah, when they're sending people to Thailand for the finale and things like that?
It's definitely more expensive than it was in the early years of the show. There is a sense that they kind of need to up the ante, so to speak, with subsequent seasons. So they are traveling to more exotic places. They're doing more exotic things on the dates. In addition, the producing talent behind the show, if you know, the way Hollywood works, the more you have success and get your show renewed, you want to get more money and get higher rates for your producing. So those costs have gone up. The host, Chris Harrison, makes more. So the show is more expensive, but when compared to the average scripted drama on television, it is still a bargain.
Let's talk about, you know, scripting TV shows, because there is one show that sort of mocks reality television, and it's a scripted show called Unreal. Tell us a little bit about that and what its appeal is, do you think, Matt?
Unreal is kind of a no-holds-barred send-up of the Bachelor genre, and the creator is someone who formerly worked on those shows, which adds an added layer of credibility to the satire. And I think, you know, it's not a huge hit in the ratings, but it's done well with the critics, and it's got a couple Emmy nominations. It knows exactly where to push and kind of exploit the things that we all all know go into these shows, but we kind of gloss over when we're watching. We know it's fake. We know a lot of these emotions are manufactured and the people are all on the show for quote unquote the wrong reasons. But the way that Unreal takes that and kind of takes it to the ultimate end game of these shows is pretty entertaining.
June, were you cajoled into watching that one too?
I didn't have to be cajoled into watching that one. I get a genuine non-guilty pleasure in watching Unreal. And I do think it appeals to a certain extent to our cynical side. As Matt was saying, we all believe that it's fake. And Unreal encourages that belief. I think that it, too, is as much of a story. You know, it's as much as of an invented narrative as The Bachelor. I think that Sarah Gertrude Shapiro, the creator who was also a producer on The Bachelor, wants us to believe that it's really, really real. And I don't know that we can do that, but it's really fascinating. And also, season two of Unreal had a Black Bachelor, which is more than The Bachelor has ever had. So I think it also offers a kind of an alternative reality to the reality franchise, which, you know, it's pushing something that really needs to happen in the real show, so to speak.
And certainly during the first season, Unreal, there was a lot of hype behind it. Has the second season, you mentioned this sort of twist, has it really lived up to its hype?
I have to say, I think it's gone slightly off the rails. It's started to deal with kind of real world things like Black Lives Matter, in the sense of the way that, you know, the police or law enforcement deal with people of color in fancy cars. It also has had a plot dealing with a character having, I guess you would say, mental health issues, which was part of season one, but is again, that, you know, the drama has ratcheted up in season two. So I think that it may be, it's kind of done more than it needed to do, and it may have lost some of that sense of reality, but it's still extremely watchable.
June Thomas, culture critic for Slate. Matt Bellany, the executive editor at The Hollywood Reporter and Billboard. Roses to you both, by the way. I'm giving roses to you both.
Thank you.
Wow, thank you.
And you get a rose, too, for tuning in today. That's our show. I'll be back tomorrow. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Take care.